Welcome to the AI Podcast. I'm Max Mitchell, podcast editor here at Engelsberg Ideas. In 1803, a desperate Napoleon Bonaparte, reeling from revolt in Haiti and the prospect of war with Britain, sold France's claim to the Louisiana Territory. Then President of the United States of America, Thomas Jefferson, was only too happy to purchase the vast territory for $15 million, a bargain at roughly 4 cents an acre. That land nowadays accounts for over a quarter of the contiguous United States, but in 1803 most of it was blank space on a map. Since the first Europeans discovered the Americas, the French, the British, the Spanish and the Dutch had all dreamed of a fabled Northwestern Passage. This, if it existed, would open up the continent to trade with the Orient and make the country which controlled it immensely rich. So it was in 1803 that Jefferson established the Corps of Discovery and named his private secretary and fellow Virginian, Meriwether Lewis, its leader. Its task was to find, in Jefferson's words, the most direct and practicable water communication across this continent for the purposes of commerce. Lewis enlisted his friend William Clark to co-lead the expedition. And over the next 3 years, one of the greatest chapters in American history played out. Joining me today on the podcast is author Craig Fairman, whose new book, This Vast Enterprise, A New History of Lewis and Clark, reconsiders that American odyssey for the first time in decades. Craig, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this is an aspect of history that has been studied and pored over for 200 years since it happened. So I guess my first question is, why now?
Well, I guess that has a personal answer and a kind of broader answer. In terms of me and my own writing, I just wanted to tell an adventure story. I just wanted to get outside and do something epic, or at least write about people getting outside and doing something epic. I was still on the couch most of the time, you know, hammering away at my laptop. But I didn't want to rehash other people's work or just tell the same story over. And so that sort of got into the other context where I wanted to make sure there was something new to say. And there's been such great scholarship done by academics all around the world on Native people and on their power and their agency and their ideas. And so I realized that kind of toolkit hadn't been applied to the Lewis and Clark expedition. And so if I could sort of bring the journals, which Lewis and Clark and their men kept journals, they produced more than a million words on this epic adventure. If I could combine that with the academic stuff, then maybe there would be something new to say. And you know, it took me 5 years to do it. So I sort of lucked into this last bit of timing, this last bit of why now. But America's celebrating its 250th anniversary. And I think Lewis and Clark is a great way to appreciate and think about that moment for the reasons you just laid out in your introduction, which is that this was kind of America's first real attempt at foreign policy. And it took us 30 years to be able to do this. It's not like the Revolutionary War ended and we're like, okay, let's be a global imperial power. I mean, America wasn't really a global imperial power even in 1803. But Jefferson was ambitious. He was looking to the future. And so if you look at the expedition carefully, I think you can kind of see the beginning of American power and America's desires to expand.
Yes, and you write in your book that it turned into a sprawling, federally funded military operation that required a broadcast of people. And I suppose this is what's so nice about your new book, is that each chapter is named after a different member of the cast of this motley crew. Why did you set it out like that? Was that intentionally to be a little bit different from what had come before that was very Lewis and Clark focused?
Yeah. I feel like a lot of my answers today will be sort of about both history and storytelling, but I hope that's okay, because to me, they don't have to be in opposition. Sometimes the best history tells the best story. And so when it comes to that scholarship about Native people, you know, I had the ideas, but that wasn't enough for me. I wanted the equality between Native points of view and American points of view not to just be reflected in the scholarship, but in the storytelling itself. So each chapter moves to a different person's point of view, which you will see this a lot in novels, but it's pretty rare in history and in nonfiction. But I wanted to do that because biography is sort of a superpower. You know, if you read a biography of Meriwether Lewis, you are by definition seeing the world the way he saw it. You're caring about what he cared about. You're worrying about what he worried about. And so I just wanted to make sure that that superpower wasn't just applied to the American side of the equation. I wanted the Native people and York, the Black man enslaved by Clark, to get that same treatment. So hopefully readers would care about them and identify with them in the same way. And this is a really different approach than most books that have been written about the expedition. You know, Stephen Ambrose's Undaunted Courage is the book that most people think of. It came out about 30 years ago. And, you know, there are people in there who, Native people like Kobowe, a leader who of a nation called the Clatsop, which was sort of on the Pacific coast that Lewis and Clark met late in the expedition. Kobowe only shows up a couple times in Ambrose's book. In my book, you get 20 pages directly from Kobowe's point of view. And I think that's more accurate because, as the scholarship has taught us, you know, Native people influenced Americans as much as Americans influenced Native people. But I also just think it's a better story. Like, all of our favorite stories have complicated people on all sides sort of conflicting and collaborating. And that's what the expedition was too. That's always the way it worked. This Fast Enterprise, the name of the book, that's a line from Clark's letters. He knew that this was an ensemble. And so I just tried to reflect that in the storytelling too.
Well, it's nice that you've not given a political, very presentist, activist reason for doing that. You know, that I feel that can take away from the power of the narrative and the actual brilliance of the story in itself, and why we are so interested in it. If we reduce it to our immediate desires and our immediate morality, you know, we just lose so much of the depth, and we start considering it in the wrong way.
I totally agree. And I worked really hard from this from day one working on this book, that I decided I don't want to moralize. Readers are smart. And so if I can just focus on telling the facts as they were at the time, then readers can kind of have the reactions that you're talking about. And different readers will have different reactions, and that's okay. So I tried really hard to make this a book not about 2026, but a book about 1804. And the stuff I was talking about with Native power, for instance, that's the truth of what life was like in 1804. The Native towns along the Missouri were bigger by population than St. Louis was. When Jefferson talked about America's dealing with Lakota, Jefferson said that the Americans were, quote, miserably weak. So this idea that Native people had real power and that this story was a two-way story, that is not a 2026 idea. That's an 1804 idea. And I tried to keep, you know, the book, I wanted to put people in the canoe. I wanted to keep the book sort of through the different perspectives in that time period. And so far, readers have said that's how it worked for them. And that means a lot to me because that's the kind of book I wanted to write.
And as we talk through the expedition, we will see that Lewis and Clark and their merry band were totally at the mercy of the people they met along the way, as well as the natural world. But let's start with how the expedition came about. So the Louisiana Purchase, there's this massive territory out west, blank space on the map. But this is something that Thomas Jefferson has thought about for years, isn't it? And it's something that there's a really fraught political divide about it as well. So could you explain a bit about the immediate context, both in terms of Jefferson, but in terms of America's political atmosphere at that point?
Sure. Yeah, and it's a really international story as well. Sometimes when you're a historian, it's hard to describe a context to people. You think, you know, how am I going to make readers feel what life was like back then? But in terms of politics, it's unfortunately very easy, because here's what Washington was like in 1803. There were two sides. They hated each other. If one side brought up a new idea, the other side didn't even need to know what the idea was. They were just like, we don't like it because it's your idea. So unfortunately, that's very much what America feels like today. And so Lewis and Clark, we sort of think about it as this all-American thing now, especially in the 250th year. But at the time, it was partisan politics. The Federalists were the other team. Jefferson was the Democratic Republicans. And the Federalists opposed the idea. This is one of the new things in my book. I did a lot of work, not in Jefferson's papers, because those have been gone through very thoroughly, but in the papers of his peers, like other senators and congressmen at this time. And you can tell by looking through their papers that they hated this expedition and they wanted to stop it. Jefferson was able to get it funded only through some brilliant political maneuvers, and I sort of trace that in the chapter that is told from Jefferson's point of view. But you're also right that he had had this idea for a long time. The Louisiana Purchase was an amazing flash of good luck, but the expedition was his lifelong obsession. It was something he had worked on for so long that when he first wrote about it in the 1780s, he asked William Clark's older brother to lead it, George Rogers Clark. And so it took decades for Jefferson to finally be able to get this off the ground. But once he did, he was worried about commerce. He was worried about the fur trade. He was worried about science. But it's also true that he was worried about land. You know, there's a senator who talked about, you know, Jefferson told me that no empire has a really robust claim to the Pacific Northwest yet. So even before the Louisiana Purchase, when that territory was still Spain's or then France's, and of course all the tensions with Britain up in the north, America was sort of trapped in the middle and worried about all that, and that contributed the expedition too. But in terms of the Pacific Northwest, nobody had sort of made a final claim to that. And so it's very clear to me that Jefferson was eyeing that land for Americans at some point. He didn't know when this future would happen, but he wanted the expedition to sort of be the first attempt to begin creating imperial and legal claims to this territory. Lewis and Clark and Jefferson were always thinking about land. Of course, so were the people who were currently living on that land as well.
It seems like such a sensible idea from Jefferson. It seems so natural to want to explore the blank map. Why were people opposed to it? Why were the Federalists opposed to this?
Well, the Federalists really wanted to keep America compact. And I mean, you can say that there were good faith reasons for this, that they were worried about sort of America not outgrowing too fast and you know, sort of undermining its footing. But there were also sort of craven reasons for this, which is that, you know, every state that got added to the West was probably going to be a Democratic Republican state, not a Federalist state. So the Federalists didn't want to dilute their political power. So as is often the case with politics, there are principled reasons and then there are, you know, more selfish reasons. But I think the biggest reason is they just hated Jefferson. One of the new lines I found in one of the letters, this Federalist senator says that Jefferson is something like he was better fit to dissect butterflies than govern a country. So they really disliked Jefferson. They disliked his idealism. And of course, this expedition was the perfect opening for them to do attack ads because Jefferson was up for election. And in 1803, it was not a given that Jefferson was going to win. So if this expedition failed, if something terrible had happened, the political ramifications would have been really severe for Jefferson. But he wanted to get this started because he knew that Napoleon and his soldiers were going to show up at any moment. Of course, we now know that they didn't, but Jefferson didn't know that in 1803. So because of the British in the north and the French coming up from the south, Jefferson was like, I've got to get this expedition moving. The tumult in Europe only intensified his desire to sort of get this idea going, because you're right, it made a lot of sense.
And so who were Lewis and Clark then? How did they come to lead this expedition? Jefferson manages to get funding for it through Congress. Why does he choose Meriwether Lewis? Who is he? And then how does William Clark come into the equation?
Well, Lewis was actually really involved in getting the funding approved because he was Jefferson's private secretary. And then if we're going to put that in modern terms, he was kind of like Jefferson's chief of staff. So when all these debates were happening at the Capitol building, Lewis was the liaison, sort of taking messages back and forth. The secret message where Jefferson tried to get the expedition started in the first place, Lewis got on a horse and took that down to the Capitol building, rode down Pennsylvania Avenue, which back then was kind of an empty, you know, very rural drive, and dropped it off. So Jefferson and Lewis trusted each other politically, and they had lived together for a couple years. But Lewis was also someone who his entire life loved to be outside. He loved science. He was a very tough guy, physically especially. And so I think what Jefferson realized is that, you know, Jefferson cared about everything. He cared about the science. He cared about the empire. He cared about the politics. But he knew that this was always going to be a military mission because he knew he was sending it to a place full of other nations that might be friendly or might not. And so it was easier for him to take Lewis, who was a tough soldier, and sort of teach him to be a scientist than it would have been to take a scientist and say, you know, here's how to use a rifle. Good luck. Clark got added later, and it's really clear if you read the Jefferson's instructions and other documents closely that this was Lewis's idea. And I think Lewis deserves a lot of credit for this idea because if you talk to soldiers even today, the last thing you want in a tense situation is a compromised chain of command. If something crazy happens, if let's say 100 Lakota people are pointing their weapons at you, which is exactly what happens to Lewis and Clark, the soldiers want one person to look to. They don't want to say, well, time out, let's have a group discussion and collaborate here. Like, they need clarity. But Lewis and Clark decided to muddy that clarity. They decided to work together as co-captains. And although that was a very unorthodox choice, history proved that it was a brilliant one because they had different strengths. They had met as young men in the army in what is now Ohio. And, you know, when Lewis would really focus on the scientific stuff Jefferson cared about, Clark could sort of focus on managing the men, which was its own kind of experiment and its own kind of job. And Lewis and Clark found ways to work together and complement each other. And I think it's one of the reasons they succeeded.
You definitely do get a sense of that in the book, that they have different talents and very different personalities. Meriwether Lewis he's got quite a depressive personality. He's prone to, quote, hypochondriac affections. But he has this, and he describes it himself when he's writing back to his family when he's in the army, he has a governing passion for rambling. Whereas William Clark, he's much more, far less emotional guy, and just probably more like the kinds of landowners like Jefferson, far less eccentric, but not a particularly nice man by modern morals. He's probably more complicated from a moral perspective than Meriwether Lewis, as we'll find out, because he had his slave York with him, and that was a very tense relationship, and York's character arc is fascinating. So how did the preparations go for this massive expedition? How did they get the men for it? And how did they obviously had to build the boats. I know that Meriwether Lewis had to go and study medicine. Clark was in charge of recording latitude and longitude, and a huge part of it for Thomas Jefferson was that they had to document everything, the flora, the fauna, how the land changed. What would the preparations must have been absolutely enormous.
Yeah, and again, you can see them collaborating in a very natural and immediate way, because Lewis was the one on the East Coast, you know, supervising the building of their big barge, which is what they used in the first year. And I do mean big. It was the size of a semi-truck trailer today. So they had this huge barge that he was building, and then he had to get that down the Ohio River to Louisville, where Clark was. But Clark hadn't just been twiddling his thumbs. He was working there recruiting people. And so the expedition ended up being made up of sort of two main groups of Americans. There were soldiers who were, you know, willing to, honestly happy to stop their sort of boring work on these isolated outposts and join this big expedition, because the expedition was viral news. Like, one thing I had noticed again and again studying newspapers from this time period, it was just like Artemis II was for us recently. You know, everybody in America was tracking this and was really interested in it. It was such a political thing to get funded, but once the headlines were like, this big expedition is going in this new area, pretty much everybody did get excited, you know, everybody who wasn't in Congress on the other side. And so Clark was, you know, the soldiers they picked up along the way, but Clark also recruited some really important people from Kentucky who were, you know, more outdoorsmen or hunters, really good with rifles. And so Clark knew a lot of these people because he had lived in Kentucky for a long time. And one of the people was York that we mentioned. York didn't have a choice to join the expedition. He was Clark's body servant, is the term that they would have used back then. So not just somebody that was enslaved, but somebody who was sort of Clark's personal servant, who would kind of take care of Clark's clothes and take care of Clark's food and really make his life as easy as possible. York didn't have a choice, but he was absolutely essential. This is one of the new things I found, whether it was unpublished letters from Clark or just reading the journals closely. You can see that you know, I don't try to just write about York as somebody who was enslaved. He was a key member of the expedition. And Lewis and Clark, to their credit, did recognize that. They, you know, at a certain point, their goal was, let's just succeed. Let's just stay alive. And they realized that York was somebody who would help them stay alive. And they relied on him.
It's very interesting you say that it's a national event, you know, because communication in those days was so sketchy. You never knew if you were going to get the letter that you needed. And news must have travelled so slowly. But as a Brit reading this, I was so naive about American geography. I didn't realise that the Ohio River and the Missouri River, I didn't realize they were part of the Mississippi Basin. I didn't realize that there was that waterway. So could you take us through how they float down the Ohio, then up the Mississippi and get to the mm-hmm. mouth of the Missouri River, where that converges with the Mississippi? Take us through, just logistically and geographically, how we get to the point where they are traveling up the Missouri.
Sure, sure. So Lewis, I'll try to use modern cities to help us picture it on a map as best we can, because you're right. It's hard not only to picture the geography, but to picture how different the physical features were the same, but the connection of knowledge and people were much different back then.
But sorry to interrupt you, but the physical features, yeah. When I've been looking on the maps, you know, these are massive cities and there's massive bridges where untouched forest would have been. So it's even very difficult from a geographical, natural point of view to trace that. So I'll let you finish.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. And the other thing we should say here are modern dams, because the Ohio River in Lewis's time, Lewis had a terrible time getting down the Ohio because the river was so shallow. You could walk across the Ohio River in some points. You didn't need the modern bridge because the water was shallow. Modern dams have changed that. But you know, in many places, there are some places where you can go and see what Lewis and Clark saw, but there are many more places where it's just completely different because of modern life. But they left Pittsburgh, which, you know, again, we can maybe picture Pittsburgh today, but back then Pittsburgh was around 2,000 people. So they left Pittsburgh and went down the Ohio River. This is just Lewis in that giant barge I mentioned. They pick up Clark and York and the other people in Louisville, and they're still going down the Ohio until where the Ohio and the Mississippi meet. And they go up the Mississippi just for a tiny little bit. It's just a couple hundred miles. And there they get to St. Louis. And St. Louis was about 1,000 people in this time period, but it was sort of the big imperial city in the West at that point. And so in St. Louis, the Missouri branches off one way, the Mississippi branches off the other. And Lewis and Clark and Jefferson knew that the Missouri from St. Louis sort of arced north and west, but they didn't know where it stopped. They didn't know how far it went. They also knew on the kind of the other end of the map that there was the Pacific Ocean and that there was a river called the Columbia River. An American had found and named that river. He got there just before somebody from Captain Cook's expeditions got there first. So already the imperial claims were starting to swirl about, you know, who can claim to have found the Columbia River and that kind of thing. So basically Lewis and Clark were like, we know there's St. Louis in the middle of the continent. We know there's the mouth of the Columbia River all the way on the Pacific coast. And we know that Columbia River and the Missouri River, they probably connect or come really close to touching at least. And maybe there are a few mountains in between. Maybe there's one range of these Rocky Mountains, as people call them, but that shouldn't be too much of a trouble. Obviously, today we know that that is not the case at all, that there's a huge region of Rocky Mountains and so many chains to deal with. But that's not what Lewis and Clark knew. They thought that they could find that Northwest Passage pretty easily, and that it would just be the Missouri and then a little bit by land and then the Columbia onto the Pacific.
So it's basically a year of preparation. I think it's January 1803 that Jefferson manages to scrape the funding, and they spend the winter of 1803-04 at the mouth of the Missouri River, and then I think it's around March, April that they finally set off up the Missouri. So what happens when they take to the Missouri, and, you know, Can you take us the next 500, 1,000 miles?
Sure. What happens is they work really hard and they move really slowly, because one other thing we should mention is that they're going against the current on this part of the Missouri. So the current was 5-6 miles an hour, sometimes higher. The river, because it didn't have all the modern improvements, there were tree trunks stuck everywhere that, you know, that current in the Missouri, it was the muddy river, right? And so there would be these tree trunks that would get stuck in the mud and then over time sort of mortared in place. So they've got their giant barge and two smaller boats and they're going against this current. Sometimes they can sail, but most of the times the only power they have is manpower, which is why the expedition was so big. Jefferson had suggested to Congress, maybe we need 10 or 12 soldiers to do this. But the party for that first year was closer to 45. And so they had all these people, they would row, they would pole, where they would take these long poles and kind of stab them into the bottom of the river and then push and walk against the pole to kind of propel the boat. Sometimes they would have to tow. They would tie a rope to the mast and just jump in the water, which could often be quite cold, and just pull as hard as they could. So they were really moving inch by inch, mile by mile. they would make it maybe 5 or 10 miles on a good day, especially early on when they were still learning how to use the boats. And sometimes the boats would get knocked off course a little bit and start to spin in the current, start to tip in the current. And then everybody's jumping in the water, just trying to keep the boat from capsizing and you know, them losing all their cargo. So it was just the physical act of movement was brutally hard. And you're also dealing with, you know, sunburn, mosquitoes, bacteria swirling around in the water. It's just a messy, brutal start. And remember, at this point, they still know where they're going. They know what the Missouri is for the first half. They know that there is a group of native people called the Mandan and the Hidatsa, who are about 1,600 miles up the Missouri. So the problem here is not we don't know where we're going. The problem is just it's hard to go anywhere in these conditions. But it was so important for them to stay on the river because the rivers were kind of the superhighway of this time period. And so that's why it was important for Jefferson's point of view that they find that direct water passage and stay on the rivers. So they just moved slowly and did the best they could. There weren't many native people at first because a lot of the native people were more away from the river hunting buffalo. But then another thing that happened within a few months of the expedition was they started having councils with native people as well and sort of focusing on diplomacy.
And that is a really interesting aspect of the book. And you're right that it does seem like the first forays into foreign policy when you think of that. And so Meriwether Lewis is sometimes jumping off and travelling on foot, taking, you know, plants and other specimens from the area. And so Clark is on the boat or on the boats more than Lewis. And you write that they try a very interesting experiment that hadn't really ever been tried in terms of discipline in the military. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. This is one of those things that was sort of always waiting there for historians to notice. I only noticed it because I took some time to read about military culture in this time period. And once you understand the baseline, the normal way that a military unit would operate, then what Lewis and Clark were doing, you can recognize how radical it was. So most American military units in this time period were a lot like continental European ones, where it was the soldiers would come from, you know, the lower ranks of society, the officers would come from the higher ranks of society. They wouldn't really interact very much. And the way that discipline was meted out was not, let's have a discussion. It was the officer grabs a cat of nine tails and just starts beating a soldier. So it was very violent. It was very hierarchical. It was very rigid. There was a lot of alcohol, a lot of testosterone. And this was just sort of what the military worked like in this time period. But Lewis and Clark decided to do something really different. In my book, I call it the experiment, kind of in a nod to the sort of Enlightenment principles that were lying behind it. But they really tried to include their men in the decision-making process. And so again and again, they would give the men votes. They would sort of poll the men and see what they wanted to do. They went lighter on the physical discipline. There were times when they needed to whip the men, but there were often times when they would forgive that discipline or give the men another chance. The court martials that would happen, normally those always had to be done by officers, but sort of by necessity, once they got past St. Louis and were kind of off on their own, there weren't enough officers to hold the court martial. So they let the regular soldiers do this. And I think they made those choices because, first of all, it was just smart in sort of a self-interested way, because the more the men were involved in the decision-making, the more the men would care about the expedition and sort of, you know, it created this kind of unified approach. But also, I think it empowered the men to react quickly because, you know, when the barge is in the Missouri and it starts to spin, you don't want the men waiting for Clark to say, everybody off the boat, you guys go on this side, you guys go on that side. You need the men to be independent and you need the men to be reactive. And so every choice that Lewis and Clark made was clearly about keeping the men motivated, but also keeping the men empowered. And this really paid off. It paid off because of Lewis and Clark's ideas, but it also paid off because of another guy that I write from his point of view named John Ordway. He was a sergeant. And in any military unit, the non-commissioned officers are the key to everything. They're the ones who are kind of in between the officers and the enlisted men. And John Ordway was one of my favorite people to write about because his experience of the expedition was a lot different than Lewis and Clark's. He was the one who was standing in that cold river doing the really hard work, but he was also one who sort of helped with morale and helped keep everybody on the same page and help make this experiment work.
So they eventually get to the Mandan tribe, some 1,600 miles up the Missouri. When you consider they're going at 10, 15, 20 miles on a very good day, that in itself is a huge achievement. But they spend the winter there in what is now, I believe, it must be modern North Dakota. North Dakota, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is when some interesting French fur traders enter the scene, and the very famous Sacagawea. So could you explain about how these characters enter, why they're immediately necessary for moving after the winter thaw?
Yeah. And this is another example, I think, of how this has always been an ensemble story. Like, we know who Sacagawea was. It's not like I'm the first book to say, hey, Sacagawea was important. But I tried really hard to show the world from her point of view, and then also to show her specific contributions. And the world from her point of view is pretty bleak. A lot of people who write about this expedition say Sacagawea was the wife of this fur trader, Charbonneau, who also accompanied them. But I don't think that's the right word. I think she was a slave. And you know, we were talking earlier about not putting moral perspectives into the past. And I'm not doing that here. Clark used this word. When Clark described Sacagawea years later, he said she was a slave. And so we know that a lot of fur traders in this time period would enslave Native people. Native people would enslave young Native women and then sell them to the fur traders. And so Sacagawea had a really tough life up to this point. She had been beaten. She had been impregnated. She had been abused. But I think that helps us understand her better too. And it makes her more inspiring because she became somebody, like you said, who is essential to them moving. After that long winter at Fort Mandan, when they continue heading west and moving through what is now Montana and Idaho, sort of knowing the Rocky Mountains are in front of them and realizing that, you know, hopefully we'll find the Columbia River shortly after that. Sacagawea was helped with translating. She helped with foraging for food. She helped them in a few spots where they didn't quite know where to go. And if we understand how much she had to overcome as somebody who is enslaved, then what she was doing makes sense. You know, she was a nice person. Anybody who ever met her and wrote about it said she was a really nice person to deal with, but she was also somebody who was strategic. You know, she had this new baby. She had a chance to get back to her people that she had been captured from. And so then the more she could work with Lewis and Clark and sort of form an alliance with them, the more they would protect her and take care of her. So it was really a two-way relationship where Sacagawea was essential to them and they were protective of her. It worked out well for everybody. And you can see that these were human beings on both sides acting in their own self-interest, but also working together to accomplish this great mission.
And she actually does make it back to her tribe where she was captured. Can you explain a bit about what happens then and how the Corps of Discovery then get onto the Rocky Mountains and what happens after that?
Yeah, it's really one of the most remarkable coincidences in global history. It's incredible because, you know, she had been taken more than 500 miles away from her people. She wanted to get back to her people, and Lewis and Clark wanted to find her people because they were starting to realize these mountains are worse than we thought, and we're going to need horses. The Shoshone were famous for their horses. We're going to need to trade for horses to be able to keep going. And so there's a line in Lewis's journal about 3 weeks before this big reunion happens where Sacagawea makes it back to where she was kidnapped, and she doesn't really show any emotion. And Lewis in his journal, in kind of a frankly, it feels kind of cruel. He just says, you know, she doesn't show any emotion. I think as long as she has enough to eat and some jewelry, she's probably just fine anywhere. But that's what Lewis saw. That's not the truth. And the reason we know that is a couple weeks later, when she made it back to the Shoshone, the tribe they ran into was not just a random tribe of Shoshone. It was her tribe. And the leader of this tribe was her brother, somebody she hadn't seen for years, somebody she thought she would never see again. And so in that moment, we know that Sacagawea broke down and sobbed. This was not, you know, a cinematic tear rolling down her cheek. She could not do her job translating because she was crying so hard. So for Lewis to say, I don't think Sacagawea really has any emotions, that's not true, because we see a couple weeks later that she had been holding all these emotions inside all along. And one thing I try hard to do in this book is as best I can, capture the interior life of Sacagawea or York. And because they didn't write journals, that's trickier. I try to use really precise language and say this is probably what she felt, or this might have been what York felt. But I think it's important because if we don't capture what she was feeling, if we don't give her that biographical treatment, that's not a more accurate book, that's a less accurate book, because we know she was feeling things in this time period. So she finds her family again. It's very emotionally cathartic for her. And then she decides, I want to keep going with this expedition, because she's an explorer too. She wanted to see the ocean. And so Lewis and Clark trade for horses from the Shoshone, and you know they've realized at this point the Columbia River and the Missouri River do not almost touch. There's actually hundreds of miles of some of the worst terrain in North America between where we are and where we need to get. And so they have about 30 horses that they load up with as much of the cargo as they can carry, and they just go through these mountains. They run out of food. They have to kill some of those horses and eat them to stay alive. The mountains are steep, so you know you'll have a pack horse in front of you. It'll lose its footing and start falling backwards, squealing in terror. And so the people are having to jump out of the way to not get crushed by a horse rolling down the mountain. It was really, really difficult to get through these mountains, and it was one of the most taxing parts of the whole expedition.
It just sounds horrific, that part. And you know, they're going through the Rocky Mountains 40 years before the famous Donner Party, the group of pioneers who got stranded on the way and, you know, infamously resorted to cannibalism and everything else like that. So what I find just amazing is how they actually managed. They must have been such brilliant planners. And the only person they lost along the way was a man who died of appendicitis or something that they could not have controlled. It's an incredible achievement.
Yeah, and there are so many things that factor into it. It's the experiment we were talking about. That's part of it because you know their last legs on the Missouri River, the current was so bad and the men were so tired that they went to Clark again and again and were like, "We're done with this river. We don't want to do this." But Lewis and Clark knew they couldn't abandon the river because the whole point of the mission was to see where the river went. So they had to rely on, you know, preserving morale and preserving military discipline, but they also had to rely on native people, not just trading for those Shoshone horses, but also one of their paths through the Rockies was a very famous native road. So they were able to know that this was a route, and they had a guy named Toby from the Shoshone who agreed to go with them, who was sort of helping them find the way. But then also they just had to rely on grit and discipline and hard work. It was, you know, they talked about in their journals when they write about the Rockies, how lonely it is, how desolate it is, how, you know, they go from it being so hot that there are wasps stinging their horses to it being so cold that there are many avalanches because the snow on the tree branches will fall on their heads. They can't find any water, so they just have to melt snow to have something to drink. It was brutally hard, but you can really see the perseverance and the dedication that they had. They knew they were on a great mission and they were going to give everything they had to achieve it.
And somehow they make it through the Rockies, and they're still so far away from the Pacific Ocean. So how do they get there? How do they make that final move to the Pacific?
Yeah, once they get on the Columbia River watershed, the good news is that the current is with them. They don't have to go against the current anymore. The bad news is that the current is really fast and there are terrible rapids and it's a really difficult portion. And so this is a chapter where I write from York's point of view because I found, like I said, some new documents that show how important he was in terms of managing the boats. And one thing that really surprised me, we've been talking about how much all the men on this expedition gave and how much Sacagawea gave, but there are some things that will sort of surprise us, I think. And one is that a lot of the men could not swim. In this time period, swimming was just not as universal as it is today. So once they get to the Columbia River, they're facing horrible rapids, huge rocks, currents that make their canoes go faster than a horse can gallop, is how one of the men put it in the journals. And so during this stretch, York was really essential because we know that he was a great swimmer and we know that he was really good in boats, that those are things that were in those new documents I found. And so when they are running these rapids, you know, Clark is sort of walking along these cliffs, looking down and sort of planning out a route. And then Lewis and York and the other men who can swim are in the empty boats while the other men who can't swim are sort of carrying the cargo by foot. And so they just go through these really horrific obstacles one at a time. They're making better time now. They're moving quickly, but they're almost moving too quickly. And they keep cracking their canoes or running into rocks. And it's a new challenge. And that's the thing about this expedition, especially in this second year. Every month, it feels like there's a new horrible challenge. They finish it and they don't get any time to rest. It's just another new challenge that they have to invent some way to overcome.
And yes, it's been 2 years that they've been on the road. What do they know from back home? They don't really know anything, do they? They at before they set off to go to the Rockies, it's fascinating that they send back some flora and fauna and a live prairie dog that they captured. They send that back to Thomas Jefferson. I found that so funny.
And it makes it to Thomas Jefferson. It survives to the White House. So it's that, you know, what a sturdy prairie dog. We should give that prairie dog some credit for being tough too. But what's really funny is that even this becomes fuel for that kind of partisan hate, because the Federal, like a prairie dog was a new animal to people in America at that time. But the Federalists in their newspaper articles were like, you know, I don't think that's actually a new animal. I think that's just a marmot. So Jefferson's overrating his own discovery. So even the can't you just see cable news today being like, is it a prairie dog? Like, let's have a panel of experts talk about this. And I mean, that's just human nature. And it was like that in 1804 to 1805 too.
Yeah. But the logistics of actually getting something back down the Missouri, 2000 miles back to DC in one piece, you know, without capsizing, right, and trusting the men that you leave these most valuable things with, that they actually get back without being intercepted, without anyone having their throat slit,
right,
by, you know, any sort of war parties. You know, the chances of it are so slim of it happening both ways. So they managed to get down the Columbia River, which you said 10 years prior an American had discovered, and a man called George Vancouver had been there as well. And
right, and he had gone a couple hundred miles up. So like they knew like Mount Hood, some of these famous mountains we know today. Once they could see them, they could say, okay, on our maps, like our maps have not had a lot of information. We've been literally filling in these maps from Fort Mandan to here. But once they start seeing Mount Hood and some of those big, beautiful mountains, they're like, okay, well, we know we're close. We can tell that the ocean is right up ahead.
And so they keep going, and they think they've reached the ocean, but they haven't quite. What happens?
Well, the river, once again, another obstacle that they could not predict for, the river becomes so much harder because of where the Columbia River gets very wide in this point, like, you know, 8-10 miles wide in some places, and it also has the Pacific Ocean coming in. So the tides become a real factor even on the river. The water, they can't really drink it as much anymore because it becomes too salty. And so they have a really hard time. They're still in canoes at this point. The barge they left to go back to St. Louis. So they're using dugout canoes that are 20 or 30 feet long, and they're dealing with huge, you know, swells and breakers that are very difficult. And, you know, around the Pacific coast at this point, there is lots of trade activity. There's Britain, there's France, there's Spain, there's ships from Russia. And sometimes these big, big ocean-going ships could not come in the Columbia because the waves were so bad. Now Lewis and Clark and York are having to face these waves in these little canoes. And so they try to stick close to the shore and make it a few miles at a time. But it was very difficult to make those last few miles. And then it's just raining. Like, their clothes are rotting. They can't keep food fresh because it's so damp. I mean, the Pacific Northwest is famously kind of like a rainforest. And so dealing with that, again, was just another challenge. They'd made it almost 4,000 miles, and sometimes it seems like the last 40 miles might have been some of the worst of the entire time.
Yeah, so they get stuck in this bay, and mm-hmm. they have to just wait until the weather clears, and the storm doesn't seem to clear for months.
No, I mean, it's you know, in the months they spent in the winter, there were, you can count the number of days that were sunny and nice on one hand. It was just soggy and miserable and brutal on top of everything they'd already endured.
But eventually they do make it to the Pacific Ocean. And what are the emotions like for Meriwether Lewis and William Clark and the rest? What do they feel?
I think they must have felt overwhelmed. I think they must have felt, you know, triumph. I mean, there's a line in Clark's journal that's pretty famous where he says, "Oh, the joy." And if we read the journal, that's one of those things that's a little too good to be true. If you read the journals, you can tell that he wrote that before he could actually see the ocean. But I don't think there's any question that the emotions were true. I was like Sacagawea's reaction to this. They ended up building a winter fort a few miles away from the ocean. And so Sacagawea had not gotten to see the ocean proper yet. She'd seen the big Columbia River, but not that. And so they build these winter quarters, and then they hear that there's a beached whale. And so that by itself is interesting, plus the ocean itself. So they put together a party to kind of hack through the rainforest by land and get to see this whale and get to see the ocean. And at first they tell Sacagawea, "You can't go." And she basically just puts her foot down and she says, "You know, I've been this," and we know this because Lewis and Clark wrote it in their journals. She's like, I've been with you guys for a year now. I've gone through everything you've gone through, and it's just, it's not fair that now that we're here, I don't get to see the ocean and the whale too. And so they let her go. And you can see in that description and in her reaction that it mattered to her to be able to see that. I think it mattered to all of them. They had, a lot of these men had never seen an ocean before. And, you know, obviously they hadn't seen pictures of it because it's a different time without the technologies we have today. I can't imagine what it would have been like to see those big dark rocks, the white waves detonating off them, ocean is, and water as far as you can see. It must have just been a religious experience. It must have just been, you know, I don't know if anything could have made everything they went through worth it, but if something could have been worth it, it would have been that view that they got to see.
Yeah, it's that amazing stretch of coastline that's in The Goonies, isn't it? And
that's right.
And One-Eyed Jack's Marlon Brando. Mm-hmm. It's amazing stretch of coastline. And so they actually give everyone a vote as well, which is so interesting about where it's another part of this experiment, this democratic experiment. They give York gets a vote, which is just incredible.
Right. In the other moments so far when they had voted on, you know, you mentioned that one guy died and so they had to pick a new sergeant, or they had to, at one point the river sort of forked and they weren't sure which way to go. So at other high pressure moments, they had given the soldiers a vote, never York. But here, once they reached the Pacific, I think probably in part because he had done so much with the rapids we had talked about, they give York a vote. And so he gets to have a say. He gets to be included as one of the people who are sort of a member of this expedition. And I think that's just a powerful moment and you know, an example of America at its best. It's also funny that they did not give Sacagawea a vote, but she spoke up for herself anyway. And that just speaks to her character. The same thing with the whale. They didn't think to ask her, but maybe later on they did, or maybe she was just like, you know, I deserve to have a say here too. And that captures her personality, how tough she was, that she thought, you know, I deserve to have a voice as well. And Lewis and Clark, to their credit, you know, recorded her voice and listened.
And so they spend this winter, terrible winter, but at least they've achieved what they needed to. They know that there's no magic Northwest Passage, and it's not just merely a day's portage from one river to the next. But they managed to get home from the West Coast in about 6 months. How do they manage that, and what happens along the way?
Well, they a lot of their work that they've had to do, they don't have to do anymore. Like Lewis isn't trying to take as many astronomical observations, and Clark's not drawing his daily maps as much anymore, and they're not looking for scientific specimens because they've done all that. They're just trying to get home as quickly as they can. They do in a couple places split up into smaller parties, and I think, you know, Lewis never says this is why I do this, but we know that Jefferson was very clear and said, do not split into these smaller parties. We, you know, keep your unit together, keep your unit safe. And so the fact that Lewis did split off into these smaller parties, I think you can sense some disappointment in that, or at least a worry that he might disappoint his mentor, Jefferson, because, you know, he wasn't going to be able to come back and say, hey, here's the Northwest Passage that you wanted, that everybody thought we would find. And so instead, I think Lewis tried to give him some smaller bonuses. And one of them was trying to go and find the latitude and longitude for this river that arced off the Missouri to the north, that if it went where Lewis hoped it would help the Louisiana Purchase be even larger. Because the Louisiana Purchase was still, you know, a live debate at this point. The deal had happened, but nobody quite knew what the deal included. And Lewis and Clark could weigh in on this. But although I understand on a human level why Lewis did that, it ended up being a real miscalculation. Because while they were on this party, they ran into some Blackfoot people, and other Native people had warned them that the Blackfoot people are very powerful and that you shouldn't do this. But they ran into some Blackfoot people. They spent a first day pretty peacefully together. But then on the second day, there was a battle, was the word that the Blackfoot people used between them, and a Blackfoot person ended up dying. This was, I think, another place where I was really able to say something new in my book, because by taking 5 years and doing that kind of careful archival research, I found an interview with one of the Blackfoot people who were there. So we've always had Lewis's journals, which are a fantastic source, but now we have a Blackfoot person telling his side of the story too. And it was so rewarding and fascinating to be able to reinterpret this moment, because I really felt like these two kinds of evidence spoke to each other, in that I would read the Blackfoot interview and that would give me new ideas, but that would also cause me to reread Lewis's journal differently and sort of notice things in the journal that other historians had missed. And one of the things I was really proud to do in my book is in an appendix, I put the interview that I found and then Lewis's journal entries, I just reprinted them both along with sort of a little bit of writing about how I made this decision. My kids are at school, and so they're always having to show their work, right? And I think historians should show their work too. So, you know, read the book, enjoy the kind of narrative, enjoy the storytelling and suspense. But at the end, if you're like, well, how does this guy know this stuff? What kind of work did he do? That appendix will let you see kind of the primary documents and why I was able to offer this new interpretation. And maybe readers will offer their own interpretations too, because this is a conversation. There are always new things to say about history, and that's one of the reasons I love it.
Yeah, your book does feel really transparent because you make a lot of conjecture. There's a lot of kind of hypothetical points where you, of course, you can't get into the inner psyche of these people. You cannot know, but you have to make an educated guess, and you know, you do manage to open up different, totally different aspects of this journey that, you know, supposedly Americans should know everything about by now. But it feels really fresh, and I was never, I grew up in Scotland, and this isn't something that we teach in school. This isn't part of our national identity and our myth. But even still, I felt that, you know, because I watched the Ken Burns documentary, and I, you know, there was just so much new, fresh material from your telling of it, which was really impressive.
Well, I appreciate that. And I just, like, I love the expedition, and I love history, and I love politics, but I think what I love most are human beings. And one thing that's really special about this expedition, because of those journals and because of other things like the interview I found, is we can really know these human beings in a way that we can't for most big things that happened in this time period. And so you don't just have this huge adventure. You have a lot of human beings who made this adventure possible. And I really tried in this book to just capture these people. I love these people. Lewis, Clark, Wolfcalf, York, Sacagawea, they felt so real to me for these 5 years. And I really wanted to capture it for readers. And there are times where I have to speculate. I mean, I have to speculate about Lewis too. We know that he almost certainly killed himself. Why? I have to speculate about him, just like I have to speculate about York. But that's where I tried to be very precise in my language. And so when I say probably or surely, to me, that's not a sign of weakness. That's a sign of care, because I'm not going to say something as definitive unless it's definitive. If it's something that I only think is 98% true, or 98% certain, I guess, that it's true, that's where I'll use that kind of hedging language. Not because I'm making things up, but because I'm making educated guesses, and I want readers to trust me that they can know when I'm guessing and know when I'm not.
So they make it back to St. Louis after having the only fatal interaction with a Native American tribe, which is itself surprising given the diplomacy on the way out. And so what is the reaction like? This has been a national story. Everyone's wondering, are they dead? You've got half of Washington, D.C., the political class is extremely annoyed that they ever went in the first place, and you know, have to eat some humble pie. What is the national outpouring now that these guys are back?
Well, they as they start to come down the Missouri again, and as they get closer to St. Louis, they start to get these first rumblings of what's happened. And I think it's really important in a book like this not to see Lewis and Clark as just destined to succeed. That, you know, they didn't feel that way. Every day they woke up and they were like, are we going to die today? Are we going to get in a battle today? What's going to happen? And so I tried to preserve that kind of uncertainty and anxiety in the story. And you can see that in the period you're talking about when they're coming back, because these traders they're meeting with are like, oh, you guys are still alive? Everybody had given up on you except Jefferson. Jefferson still believed. And one of the first things Lewis and Clark ask are, is Jefferson still president? Did he win re-election while we were gone? Because they just didn't know. You know, just like we don't know what's going to happen in the next presidential election, they didn't even know either. And they were very isolated from their country and from the news. And so they finally make it back to Washington in late 1806. Jefferson had won re-election. His party had become only more popular. And so there was the Federalists were eating humble pie for more reasons than just Lewis and Clark. And the expedition, they were celebrities. You know, when they met those traders, the traders would be like, here's chocolate, here's biscuits, here's wine, here's the food that you haven't had. You know, this was for our mission, but we want to celebrate you. And that continued on the slow progress from St. Louis to Washington, where at every step, there would be a big ball or a big bonfire to celebrate Lewis and Clark. And so I found these journals of of a British diplomat, actually, who lived in Washington, D.C. And he talked about, you know, Lewis would show up at a play at a theater and people would just mob him before and after the play and just ask him questions. How tall were the trees? Were the native people cannibals? Like, you know, just all these questions. What did buffalo tongue taste like? And so Lewis would field these questions. They were so celebrated and people were so excited, not just that they had made it back. They were excited for the book Lewis had promised to write, just like Captain Cook and Vancouver would write these authoritative books that would sort of be the final step of the exploration they had done. You know, the book was the point. It was the way to disseminate the knowledge to other Enlightenment audiences. Everybody thought Lewis would write the same, but of course, tragically, he did not write that book.
Yeah, and so can you tell us what happens to Lewis and Clark after the expedition?
Well, Clark moves back to St. Louis, and he becomes basically America's top diplomat for working with Native people, and that's a very powerful position he will hold for decades. When you think about all the territory, the Louisiana Purchase was basically made America hold what's called the preemption rights and sort of the ability to negotiate with Native leaders, but there were still a lot more deals to make to actually buy the land, and William Clark, in this diplomatic role, he does all that. He also brought York with him, which was a sign of how their relationship, however much they worked together when they had that vote on the Pacific. Once they got back to America, York wanted to stay in Kentucky where his wife lived. And Clark said, no, you're coming with me. And we know from Clark's letters that York argued with him and said, you know, I've done so much. I was with you every step of the way. I think I've earned my freedom. Clark said, no, you haven't. You're coming to St. Louis. So Clark was in St. Louis, and you can see the kind of moral complexity of him, that he was Native people at this time would say that Clark was often, you know, better to negotiate with than other American people. I think that Clark was more generous in his views of Native people even than Lewis was. But in terms of Black people and slavery, Clark had a much different view. And in the book, I just try to portray each person as they were in that time period. You know, even Lewis and Clark, two people who worked together, who had very similar backgrounds, they had much different views. And I just try to present each person as they were. But Lewis in St. Louis, he becomes the governor of the Louisiana Territory. And I try not to armchair quarterback too much in these kind of books. I feel like, you know, I'm just going to describe what they did, and that's enough. They had a lot to deal with. But I think Jefferson made a mistake here, because Lewis was somebody who needed deadlines and needed support. And instead of that, Jefferson elevated him to this really important political position while Lewis also still had to write this book. And we know Lewis was exhausted from this expedition. One of the biggest things I found in the archives was a letter from John Quincy Adams, who had known Lewis before the expedition, and then after, when Lewis gets back to Washington, John Quincy Adams has dinner with him. And John Quincy Adams says, I didn't even recognize this guy. He looks like he's aged 15 years. And so it's incredible to have that eyewitness account that we can see what the expedition took from Lewis. And then he has this book deadline, and he has all these political jobs that he has to do, and he kind of spirals. We know that his depression starts to bother him again. We know that he struggles with drinking, and eventually he ends up killing himself and not finishing the book. And this all happens in only a couple years after the expedition. It's so sad to know that he was able to accomplish so much and be on the top of the world, and then have it end in such personal tragedy.
And William Clark, he ends up, by some strange twist of fate, adopting Sacagawea's children. How does that happen?
Well, that's one of those things that there are a lot of different versions of what may have happened to Sacagawea after the expedition. And I think, you know, I think I'm going to do what maybe historians should do more often sometimes and say, I don't know exactly what happened. There are Native traditions that suggest she lived a long time after the expedition, and that may well be true. But I can tell you what Clark thought. Clark thought that she died pretty shortly after the expedition, which is just as much of a tragedy as what happened to Lewis. But one thing Clark did is he became the legal guardian, not just for the boy, Pompey, who went on the expedition with them, who was now older, and Clark paid for his schooling and sort of took care of him, but also a daughter named Lizette, who was born after the expedition. And so Clark was kind of their legal guardian in St. Louis and tried to take care of them. Maybe Sacagawea died around 1812. There are some written documents that suggest that happened, but maybe the Native traditions are true instead, and that she lived decades after out on the West, you know, continuing to be that kind of compassionate and strong person we know that she was from the journals.
And Lewis and Clark's story really fell out of favor, didn't it, in the 19th century, and then made a bit of a resurgence. What has the afterlife and its legacy been like?
As with everything else with this expedition, it's so complicated, right? Because Lewis died and couldn't finish the book. Clark wasn't the writer that Lewis was, so he brought somebody else in to help him work on the book. And the book did come out. It was widely reviewed in Europe. Robert Southey, a very important British romantic poet, wrote a 50-page review of the book. It kind of took some cheap shots at the Americans and at Jefferson, but was also just genuinely impressed at what the men were able to overcome. So the book had an immediate impact for sure. But then the War of 1812 happened. Lewis's scientific discoveries that he had worked so hard on, the person who was in charge of publishing that never came through. And so a lot of the influence sort of disappeared for a long time. And when they re-entered the kind of popular imagination, and they basically never left it since, was in the 100-year celebration around 1904. There were some new books and some new celebrations. Someone finally edited the full journals or close to it. And so from 1904 on, they have been the kind of Lewis and Clark that we imagine from Ken Burns or from Stephen Ambrose, or hopefully now from my book, this sort of bigger story. But, you know, if they are America's epic, and I really think that they are, one thing that's amazing is we can sort of find new meanings in them each time. And so what I tried to do in my book was celebrate Lewis and Clark and find new things about them, like those John Quincy Adams letters, but also find a way to say that John Ordway, the working class soldier, this is his story too. York, this is his story too. And I think that's one of the reasons it feels so American, is that there are people from every walk of life who gave everything they had in this kind of shared and incredible journey.
I totally agree. And it's a real achievement on your part. And I'm lucky enough to be traveling to Idaho and Wyoming next week. So you've really brought Yellowstone and the Missouri headwaters to life for me. And I'm thankfully going to have a much easier time than Lewis and Clark had. But Craig Fairman, thank you so much for being on the Engelsberg Ideas podcast today.
Hey, this has been an absolute pleasure. Safe travels and enjoy those vistas. They still take our breath away today.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.